It's WrestlePod, the Troopany Show, with your host, James Troopany.
Hello and welcome to the Troopany Show. My name is James Troopany. This is my show, as you will know, as you are tuned into the WrestleTalk Podcast Network, where you can find us, the Squash, and the Finlay Martin Report on your favourite podcast providers if you're watching this on YouTube. If not, you're already watching this or listening to us. I hope you're having a good day anyway, whilst I tie myself in logical knots. We are here to go back to our beginner's guide to Japanese wrestling. And last week we talked about Bound for Glory, and this week we're moving back into our beginner's guide. And to join me and guide us through the momentous occasion of the early 1970s, will you please welcome Miss Chelsea Spolin of ShouldersUp.net. How are you, Chelsea?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
I'm okay. I did a gig last night. Well, we did a rehearsal last night, and it was in our bass player's house, and he's kind of like converting a barn, and there was like a barbecue in the corner, and it was really cool. So there was a fire to keep us all warm. Unfortunately, I inhaled smoke fumes for like 3 hours. And like,
oh no,
I like was coughing up soot when I got home.
That's
so
horrible.
Yes, it was lovely. And if you look up Our Idol, you'll see the pictures on Our Idol on Facebook. Scunthorpe Rock Open 2 weeks time. You can listen to us there if you're in Scunthorpe. There's a couple of you in Scunthorpe. You might want to come down and see us. But yeah, you can see us. But it was fun. It was a great like way to practice, and it was really cool. However, yeah, smoke inhalation fumes. That wasn't nice. Anyway,
the price you pay for your art.
This is it. You plow through. Right, we'll go for a short break because even as artists have to pay the bills, and we'll see you on the other side.
WrestlePlus.com is the brand new home of incredible online wrestling content featuring uncensored shoot interview classics, full series of WrestleTalk TV and British Wrestling Weekly, exclusive documentaries, British wrestling's biggest names before they were stars, an incredible podcast collection, up to 90% off merchandise offers, and the brand new Power Slammed e-magazine forwarded by Finn Martin himself. WrestlePlus has thousands of hours of content with new and exclusive releases added regularly. You can join today for the stupidly low price of just £4.99 a month. Wrestle Plus, because this is wrestling.
Welcome back. So then, New Japan Pro Wrestling was founded in 1972 by Antonio Inoki. And that's the bit of time we're really looking at today. The stretch between 1972 and around about the early 1980s in the heavyweight division. We're probably going to spend a little bit of time on the junior heavyweight division separately, because that's a whole big subject by itself. And really changed the way pro wrestling is perceived and echoes through to this day. But I wanted to talk about the heavyweights because that was where everything really came from. And that was really what put the whole thing together as far as New Japan Pro Wrestling is concerned. Now, Chelsea, you've been a New Japan fan fairly recently and you've been away researching this week and watching things. What was your impression of this particular time period for New Japan Pro Wrestling?
So it seems like there was a lot of political backstabbing behind the scenes.
Yes.
Like, I know one of the reasons that Inoki founded New Japan Pro was that he had tried to achieve control of the Japanese Wrestling Association, and the other people involved were disappointed in that, and so they kicked him out.
Yes.
That was really interesting. It sounds like there's probably a little more drama there than we'll actually ever know the full extent of. It's also interesting, like, I was trying to get as much information as I could about how the public perceived pro wrestling as an art form, and it's hard to get a sense of how many people knew that it was potentially staged and how many people didn't know that, because when you watch videos of stuff that was filmed from back then, the audiences don't react the way that I'm used to. They're very, very quiet. They get excited about things and they clap and they cheer, but it's really hard to get a sense of their perception of what they're watching. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you listen to a Western wrestling crowd today, there's obviously a lot of in-jokes and there's a lot of things going on that are, how can I put it,
they're in on the joke.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. The narrative is fueled by what we know the audience already knows, where there is none of that with Japanese wrestling in the 1970s. It's very similar to British wrestling in the 1970s as well. You know, you don't get that visceral response. Say, if you watch videos of Bob Backlund at The Garden, or Billy Graham, or Bruno at The Garden even, there's a very visceral response, isn't there? You know, these are very popular athletes. Whereas in the UK and in Japan, you didn't get that. It was very, like, clap a nice move, and oh, that was good, we'll give that a clap as well.
Right.
You know, unless there were, like, absolute killer heels in the ring, then you get a negative reaction. But that's not really the same thing, is it?
It's very formal, yeah, which is interesting.
Yeah, and it was an interesting time period, really, for wrestling development, and certainly because there was really a power vacuum. And we'll go back a little bit, as Chelsea's just touched on it. Antonio Inoki was really Ricky Dozan's chosen one, or one of these chosen two, shall we say. The other was Shohei Giant Baba. And if you look at Baba and Inoki's records, they're the ones that took over in the JWA after Ricky Dozan's death, which, if you want to learn more about that, if you go back to our episode one, where we explained about Ricky Dozan and his impact on pro wrestling. Now, in 1966, Inoki leaves JWA. He goes to Tokyo Pro Wrestling, a small independent company, and does quite well, becomes the top guy there, and leaves because of turmoil behind the scenes. He goes back to the JWA, forms a tag team with Baba called B.I. Cannon, which is like the dominant tag team in JWA. And then, as you said, he tries to take over the promotion, and it doesn't go well. And to be honest with you, Inoki is a fascinating character, in much the same way I'm fascinated with Hulk Hogan, not necessarily because he's a great wrestler, but the way he seems to have this lore of the crowd absolutely adore Inoki in this time period. He's so, so over. And it is like, you know, you look at him as a guy, he's clearly kind of strangely handsome and charismatic, but there's nothing really special in his wrestling style. There's nothing really that grabs the attention. It's just like the total package, and his ability to form New Japan Pro Wrestling basically from scratch with a little help from his friends, and some very important friends we'll talk about as well. It is quite remarkable how he managed to do that.
It's his determination, I think, that comes across pretty much no matter what he's doing. Like, I watched 5 or 6 of his matches to prepare for this, and he's, no matter what he's doing, no matter who his opponent is or what their particular approach is, I mean, he's so focused, you know? And it's interesting, you mentioned that he's sort of like, that he doesn't have a hallmark to his style of something that he does super, super well. It seems like he's sort of like perfectly average at everything.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. And he had also incredible self-belief and in an ego the size of China. Let's be honest with that. From the very get-go, we have to mention how egotistical Inoki is. And you can see what we know about Inoki now after 40 years later and watching his career and how it's developed, and you can see there are certain people he did things with which he perhaps shouldn't have done. You can see how that manifests itself. One of the early stories, and Bruno Sammartino told this story on The Art of Wrestling, was he was tagging, I can't remember who he was tagging with, but Bruno was wrestling Inoki in a tag match. And Inoki shot on Bruno Sammartino, and genuinely tried to put a front face lock sleeper hold on him, a guillotine, which Bruno just powered out of, because Bruno's double hard. Even now, in his 70s, I wouldn't be in a street fight with Bruno, he'd kill me. And he's like 75. So you can imagine, in his absolute prime, 260 pounds, you know, a proper hardcore shooter, and Inoki tries to take something on with him, which he really shouldn't have done. And then Inoki allegedly refused to re-enter the ring and tagged in Baba to finish the match out. So
that was polite of him.
Yes. So if you are either crazy enough or egotistical enough to think you can take on Bruno Sammartino, one of the most world's renowned shooters at the time, and expect to get away with it, that's a pretty healthy ego.
Yes.
Yes. And that's kind of what drives things forward. And we all know that wrestling promoters need to have a healthy ego. I'm sure one Vincent Kennedy McMahon's ego is well stoked on a daily basis.
I was going to say.
Yeah. As far as, you know, as far as egos in pro wrestling is concerned, Inoki is not by himself, though he may have even a larger ego than Vincent Kennedy McMahon. So it's really, you're right, it's his drive that gets New Japan Pro Wrestling off the ground. They start in 1971, really. 1972, after the fail of the takeover. And his first match is with Carl Gotch. And Carl Gotch is a very important name in New Japan Pro Wrestling, and very important name in Japanese wrestling in general. But Gotch's influence on New Japan is what starts Strong Style, the form of wrestling we know and love today from New Japan Pro Wrestling. But this is where the genesis of Strong Style is. Carl Gotch, as a trainer, is someone who runs the New Japan Dojo for the next 10 years or so and really instills a sense of realism into New Japan Pro Wrestling.
Gotch is a really interesting figure. I was surprised watching a lot of his matches how much stuff looked familiar to me, like how much it stylistically looked familiar to me based on modern stuff I've watched today.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would have thought to call it Strong Style if I hadn't, you know, done some research into him beforehand, but he's very smooth, very technical, and he's very, for lack of a better word, stiff at everything. Like, everything he does is stiff, not just how he hits his opponent or how he takes bumps. Like, when he puts you in a submission, it looks like it hurts.
And it probably did.
Yes.
Because Carl Gotch is, if you've ever watched any documentaries about Carl Gotch or read anything about Carl Gotch, Carl was a guy, well, he was Belgian via German descent. He was always kind of described as German. And, in the wonderful misplacement of wrestling promotion, you can be described as from anywhere. But generally speaking, he was German. Trained in Europe, and he always thought he was the best shooter in Europe till he got to the UK and fought guys from Wigan and got beat. So he went to Wigan to learn how the snake pit worked and how did they do it. And he helped build the snake pit, actually. You know, he was a guy who helped build Riley's reputation worldwide. And then he goes off and he tries different things to learn how to be the best shooter he can be, as well as being the best technical wrestler he can be. And he sees that as his place in life. And unfortunately for him, he tried his way in North America, but it didn't work out. He was essentially blackballed by the NWA because they didn't trust him. And, you know, he was really, Japan was his last kind of grasp at the big time, and they loved him in Japan because he was so genuine, because he was this guy who loved genuine professional wrestling and wanted to make it as realistic as he possibly could. And I think that's what drew Inoki to him.
I mean, Inoki always talks about how much they influenced each other, but I mean, Inoki always credits Gotch with being the other person who trained him.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty respectable pedigree.
Yeah, definitely. And if you look at the other big stars they were bringing in at the time, you also had Luthez, who ended his association with JWA. He wasn't really doing an awful lot for the NWA anymore. He was at the end of his career. He was working for a lot of promotions in the North American scene that weren't necessarily NWA affiliated. And New Japan was not NWA affiliated. And we'll get to that in a moment. But Luthez was, you know, still a name. Obviously, the big feud he had with Ricky Dozan was really important, and it created a blessing for New Japan Pro Wrestling, because one of the biggest names in wrestling history is suddenly a main event star for New Japan. Even if he's 10 or 15 years past his prime, Luthez didn't stop like actively wrestling until he was 73, so, you know, he had a while to go yet. So, yeah, it was... Between Thez and Gotch and Inoki and the other guys that he'd taken with him from JWA, he had a good core of what how to create a wrestling promotion in Japan, I think.
There's a cool match you can watch on YouTube, too, that has Gotch and Luthez in a tag match against Inoki and Seiji Sakaguchi.
Yeah, I watched that one as well.
It was very informative.
Yeah, it and it kind of explains how those early days of Strong Style were going to work. It's going to be very, very traditional. It's going to be very much holds and counter holds and counter wrestling. And there's some really interesting stuff going on in there. And you can see kind of like the martial arts influence isn't there yet, but there's little bits that Inoki's trying to put into it that makes it that way.
Yeah. And I mean, Inoki's hits all look like real devastating hits. And I mean, they probably were. He probably did really hit as hard as he could.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because I can't help but watch those matches trying to figure out like what's a work and what's not. And you can't tell really. They're all so committed to making it look as much like a real fight as possible.
Yeah, and that's really what they were after. Now, the politics of New Japan Pro Wrestling, their main promoter was a guy called, I haven't pronounced this properly, Hisashi Shinma. Am I correct there?
Yeah, close enough.
Now, Hisashi Shinma was one of the bookers for New Japan Pro Wrestling and ended up being the president of the WWE, or in the lineage of the president of the WWE. He was the guy who was president before Jack Tunney. So,
wow, I didn't know that. That's actually really interesting.
Yeah, and which obviously leads you to believe that there was some kind of a working agreement between WWE and New Japan Pro Wrestling. And there was. For very good reasons. So we should look at world politics, because everything, as we've talked about before with the JWA, was world wrestling politics. How the NWA affected JWA was really important. We talked about Lou Thesz, the NWA International title, the NWA International Tag Team Championships, how the NWA molded JWA into being just another territory, just like Texas, just like New York, just like the Carolinas, another place where the NWA could make money. And certainly that was very important to Japanese business, because when the big American wrestlers came in, there was that nationalist angle. You still had that. And, of course, they were the ones with the championship belts. So they were the ones that were going to bring in the most money. Now, New Japan Pro Wrestling were absolutely desperate to be part of the NWA. However, at the same time as the New Japan Pro Wrestling had been founded, Giant Baba had founded All Japan Pro Wrestling in around about 1973, a little bit after New Japan Pro Wrestling. And really, that was the lineage of the old JWA. Now, we'll talk about All Japan Pro Wrestling in a little while, because we have to break back and forth between these wrestling companies, because there's so many of them. So we will break back to All Japan Pro Wrestling in a couple of weeks. However, they took the NWA affiliation with them, and they were the NWA affiliates in Japan, which meant New Japan Pro Wrestling could not be an NWA affiliate, because as the rules of the NWA stood, there was only one promoter in each territory. Japan was considered, the entire nation was considered a territory. Now, technically, if they were being like old school NWA about it, they should have sent their biggest stars to try and shut down New Japan Pro Wrestling, but that didn't happen because there was plenty of other people who were willing to work with the NWA, sorry, willing to work with New Japan Pro Wrestling, because, you know, there was outlaw promoters in certain areas who'd been shut down quite violently by NWA promoters, because they would just bring in the NWA heavyweight champion, the US heavyweight champion, the tag team champions, put on these star studded cards for 3 months and end till the outlaw promotion was just dead, because the territory had been burnt out, and then they'd start again from scratch. That didn't happen in Japan, because there was plenty of people like Carl Gotch, who'd been blackballed by the NWA, who was not interested in working with the NWA and quite willing to set somebody up in opposition.
So what you're saying is wrestling is a little like the mafia in every era.
A lot like the mafia. In every possible way. Yeah, you don't get that anymore, right. Theoretically, but you do get, you know, I know a local wrestling promoter around here. I was talking to a local promoter whose posters got ripped down by another wrestling company.
That's really, really, that, I don't know, that just seems like it's bad for everybody.
Yeah,
though.
It's childish as well as bad for business, but there you go. So, you know, even though, well, you know, no one's getting given concrete shoes anymore, let's put it that way. So it's better than it was. And, you know, and there's also, as we're talking about mafia, obviously a new wrestling company has to get money from somewhere. And, you know, if you look through Wikipedia, obviously it doesn't explicitly say that a new wrestling company in Japan in the mid-70s, where money was scarce, was going to be funded by certain organizations with less than fabulous reputes. But, you know, whenever you talk about pro wrestling in Japan, the Yakuza aren't far behind. And I don't know where New Japan got their money from. And they seem to have been stable and certainly are a completely Yakuza-free entity these days. But there's always, you know, there's always those things in the background, shall we say.
They may not be Yakuza-free these days. I don't know. You'd be surprised how many legitimate businesses in Japan have Yakuza ties if you look closely enough.
Yeah. I mean, if you, I mean, the thing that strikes me was a story Mick Foley told in his biography about when he was working for IWA Japan, Tigerjeet Singh took him out for dinner one evening with his sponsors. And as he looked down the row of the table, he saw that every one of them had a missing little finger and a tattoo sneaking out from the sleeve of their shirt.
I actually saw a guy on the train one time in Osaka who was missing the tip of his finger and had tattoos on his hands.
There you go. So
it was a very cool feeling, very weird feeling. A little uneasy.
Yeah. Get off at the next stop.
Yes.
So yeah, so you know, there is evidence, kind of circumstantial evidence there about how the Japanese promotions have been funded, and certainly when we get to the 90s we'll talk about the Yakuza a lot more. But for now, let's safely assume New Japan Pro Wrestling is going great guns. But the one deal that they did land, which was really important to them as far as international trade was concerned, as far as getting big stars in, was the fact that they managed to strike a deal with the WWF, as it was then, as promoted by Vince McMahon Sr., which meant access to the WWF champion Bruno Sammartino, later Bob Backlund. I don't think Billy Graham ever went over. I don't think he was champion long enough to do any tours over there. And it was interesting times for New Japan, because you got all of these big stars. And one of the best matches I have actually saw of this era was Dusty Rhodes challenging Bob Backlund for the WWF Championship in Tokyo, which sounds a bit strange, but the house was packed. They were incredibly hot for the match, and it was a really, really good match as well.
Dusty Rhodes was one of those guys who was sort of over everywhere, right?
I mean,
like, I don't know that I've ever seen a Dusty Rhodes match ever where the crowd didn't know exactly who he was and wasn't excited about him.
Yeah, and if it wasn't working, you'd just bring Dick Murdoch along and they'd do it as... they'd get over that way. I can remember I was watching some New Japan stuff from the same era, and Dusty's getting beat down by the heels and Dick Murdoch comes and makes the save. You know, and the crowd goes crazy, just like they would have done in Florida and just like they would have done in Minnesota. And it's just like they had a routine down of how to get over as a duo. No matter where they were in the world, they'd figure it out. And it was just like, take this package and tweak it. And it was just, it's just poetry in motion to watch. You know, you can watch those early days with Dusty turning face in Florida, and then you watch him go to the Garden, and you watch him go to Tokyo, and it's the same things. He's just doing the same things and just a slight tweak here and there. Funnily enough, the Backlund match I was talking about, Dusty worked heel.
Really?
Yeah, because it started off as a sportsmanlike affair, and I think Dusty ended up, Bob, I think, bladed in the match. And it ended up in a kind of disqualification. And then Dusty broke some rules at the end, and to cover himself, just kind of like snuck out the ring when the match had been called in a disqualification finish. Because obviously they weren't going to give away a championship change in Tokyo that they could sell for close circuit money in the States. So yeah, it was an interesting match to watch, and you know, but they were kind of working North American style. They weren't doing anything different to things I'd seen them done in matches of that era, and it makes a great mix for New Japan at that point. You've got so many things going on,
which is, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about the birth of strong style. Like, it's interesting how many styles had to come together in order to create what we sort of think of as modern strong style.
Yeah, there is still that element of North American entertainment matched in with a serious sporting product. There is a lot of stuff going on in here, isn't there? It isn't just, you know, a champion and someone works their way through the contendership to get to the championship. You know, there's a lot of things going on there, you know. And that help from the WWF, by gum, I'm glad they changed those initials.
It's a bit of a tongue twister.
It is, isn't it? That certainly kind of like set them on the world stage, because, you know, Bruno certainly was considered like the guy. He was massively popular in the Northeast, obviously. And he was also popular in South America. The WWF champion toured down there and was a very popular attraction in South America. and they considered him to be the world's champion. And in Japan, as New Japan became bigger, the WWWF Championship, when Bob Backlund went over, he was considered to be the world's champion as New Japan became more prominent. Now, obviously, Inoki also had a world championship as well, the NWF Heavyweight Championship, which was originally from the North, the New York, Canada area, in another outlaw promotion that wasn't affiliated particularly with anyone. The original champion of that was Johnny Powers in 1970, who was defeated by Waldo Von Erich, and then he was defeated by Dominic DiNucci, the man who trained Mick Foley, Abdullah the Butcher, Ernie Ladd, all these big names from independent big name wrestling in the States. And then Antonio Inoki takes the title from Johnny Powers in 1973 when he was working for Tokyo Pro, and then he takes it with him to New Japan Pro Wrestling, and that became the key championship for a while in New Japan Pro Wrestling. And actually, there's a shout back to that in the early 2000s, but we'll get to that in a few episodes' time, probably about 12. But he takes this championship and tries to make it his own in New Japan Pro Wrestling. But it's not a championship of its own lineage. It's a championship of borrowed lineage from somewhere else, trying to get that association thing going again. I mean, one of the other big names, yeah, this was the point, one of the other big names who came with the WWF package was Andre the Giant. Did you see any of the matches with Andre?
And I did, and it's interesting. I feel like I'm so desensitized to Andre the Giant as an entity because WWE makes so much of a deal out of his legacy that I wasn't expecting the crowd to react to him as though they were genuinely a little scared of him.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting to see. Because, like, for example, you know, like, if you go to a WWE show now, they have Big Show, but nobody's scared of Big Show. And I don't know how much of that is just that people have the internet and know that that guy is really not a monster. But Andre, people seem to be genuinely scared of him. Yeah. And I watched a match he had with Inoki where Inoki treats it like he's really fighting a monster who could potentially kill him. It looks very dangerous.
Yeah.
When they're in the ring together.
Yeah, and I have the same opinion as you. I've watched so many Andre matches from the 80s where Andre was at the end of his time, and he knew he was at the end of his time. And people kind of misplace Andre because Andre had an incredible wrestling IQ. He was one of the smartest wrestlers in the world. He never did much because he's Andre the fucking Giant. He doesn't have to do much.
Right.
he's the guy. He's it in pro wrestling. And you go back to the 70s and he's wrestling in Japan and it's a completely different Andre. And there's only 5 years, and I know there was a lot of health issues in those 5 years between WrestleMania 3 and, say, 1978, where he's wrestling Inoki on a regular basis. And there's a lot of health issues, which goes with giantitis, and none of it was his fault. And he started putting on weight, and there was a bunch of stuff going on, and none of it was Andre's fault, and God rest his soul, and God rest him for everything he's done for pro wrestling. However, you look back at those matches with Inoki in the 70s, and he's wrestling him as well. You're right in the sense of, like, Inoki is scared, and Inoki is a, clearly a big challenge for him, but Andre's wrestling him. He's doing wear down holes, and he's grapevining the leg, and he's putting on sleepers, and he's chin locking him, and he's chain wrestling him. And that's not the Andre we see from the WWE. We see the big tests of strength. We see the things that Vince McMahon Sr. taught him to do so he could get the most out of the least effort, so that they could make the most money. Then he goes to Japan and he's clearly having the time of his life actually getting to wrestle somebody for a change. Because, when Andre started, he started in Europe, obviously being French, and he wrestled he was just a big guy who wrestled really well. You know, he did drop kicks, and he was a chain wrestler. He just happened to be 7 feet tall and 350 pounds. And when he got to Canada, he got booked in Canada, from what the stories I mentioned, he got booked in Canada, and they overexposed him. like in the space of like a month, and his drawer completely gone. And then Vince McMahon Sr. heard about him, and he was the one who sent him around as an attraction. He wasn't there as like a resident. He would go and do a week in Texas and a week in Portland, and then he'd go to Japan for Inoki. And so he was doing different things for different audiences, and that's what helped that wrestling IQ, which meant that main event at WrestleMania 3 was as good as it possibly could be, given the limitations of the people involved in the match. But also, you know, Andre in this match with Inoki, he's wrestling him. He's putting in a good performance, you know.
Yeah.
For the matches of the time.
Yeah, it's incredible. I sort of felt like when I was watching it, like Inoki elevated him, you know, like sort of not elevated him in terms of a story sense, but elevated him in terms of like, you know, how wrestlers feed off each other.
Yeah.
Like their dynamic is enhanced by both of their personalities at the time. And I felt like Andre was sort of taking some of his cues from Inoki, which was really, really interesting.
Yeah. It's very. It is a different world watching Andre in that era. And I think everyone should go back and look at those matches, because it just puts Andre in a different light. And you think about the other things he did. And we talk about, look, Andre's become this mythical figure because of his early passing and because of the things he did. And the road stories about Andre and the, was it 157 beers he could drink and didn't really faze him that much.
Yeah.
And all those
And the story
things.
Of him getting so wasted and he fell asleep on the floor of a hotel and he was so big that nobody could move him, so they just let him sleep there.
Yeah. So you get all those mythologies, but, you know, you forget that actually he had to be some good, you know. No one's writing these mythologies about Giant Gonzalez, are they? You know, this is a guy who really knew what wrestling was and really knew how to make the best out of what wrestling was. And, you know, and Vince McMahon Jr. made him a road agent. So you have to have a good wrestling IQ to be a producer at that level. And he knew exactly what to get out of this. And Inoki took it for everything he could. Some of the other big names and the big heel names, though we talk about New Japan and Strong Style and the sports kind of element, what really interests me is two of the biggest names as far as heel runs in New Japan were concerned were Abdullah the Butcher and Tiger Jeet Singh. And you don't really get much more gimmicky than Abdullah the Butcher and Tiger Jeet Singh. You know, Abdullah went to New Japan in the late 1970s. Abdullah always swapped around, never outstayed his welcome, did what he could, and then disappeared. And it had become a big name in all Japan. Had a really good title match with Billy Robinson, actually, which we talk about Clash of Styles, but we'll talk about that in the All Japan episode. But the Abdullah comes in, he's this stone cold killer. And again, there's switches of his character in New Japan Pro Wrestling. I was watching, I think, one of the other matches we looked at this week. He comes in and he challenges Inoki for the NWF Championship. And now Abdullah, everywhere he went in North America, had a manager. He never spoke because the fans would know he wasn't from Ethiopia.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah, the fans wouldn't know he wasn't from Sudan then. If he spoke English, you can't do that, can you?
See, it never occurred to me. To me, it just seemed like it enhanced his mystique.
Partly that. And also because it's like, well, if he's the madman from Sudan, then he should be speaking Sudanese, but he isn't. I don't know what language they speak in Sudan. But, you know, he's because that is one of the reasons why. He goes to Japan and he cuts his own promos, and the very direct, strong promos as well. And he was a great promo guy, but he didn't have to say as much in Japan because, obviously, the audience isn't going to understand as much. And, you know, the commentators have to explain it. So, you know, the shorter it is, the better off he is. But he comes in as this big, imposing figure. And he obviously can't do the deathmatch style that he's used to everywhere else in New Japan. He has to be a conservative ground game wrestler with a lot of cheating involved because it's Abdullah. But he's an interesting character, I think, in this style that's developing that is less showmanship, more about sports. I think that's really interesting.
I think it's interesting to me that the legacy of it being more of a sports-based style seems to be true today. Like, it's, I think that's one of the things that sort of sets New Japan Pro apart from a lot of other wrestling promotions, is that it gets treated like a serious sport by the audiences and by the presentation of the product. Whereas I feel like, you know, if I'm comparing it to WWE, I feel like WWE treats its product like theater.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. You know, and to an extent, most North American wrestling companies do, if you see what I mean. You know, whereas to an extent, New Japan doesn't. It's starting to creep in a little bit more now, but I mean, you have characters like Naito and Bushi and Evil, but
right,
they wouldn't get over unless they were good wrestlers first.
Right. Everybody who gets to play ball at that level is exceptionally talented.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting how that's developed. It's kind of like gone in reverse, you know. I mean, the classic example of that is Tiger Jeet Singh, who is a terrible wrestler. All Ends Up was never any good. I have not seen a Tiger Jeet Singh match that I have been interested in from his wrestling ability. I've been interested in the guys who wrestled him and the guys who made him a star, like Inoki. And he really got over by beating Inoki when Inoki never lost. You know, so he had a couple,
right,
you know, he got a couple of pinfall victories. And you also, I mean, you look at down the years, obviously wrestling fans find things and put them on YouTube. And trying to find Tiger Jeet Singh stuff is really hard because no one really likes him that much. You know, he's not got that following like Abdullah does or The Sheik or, you know, other guys who weren't necessarily great wrestlers but were great draws, great attractions, people who had a mystique, right, about them, like Andre. You know, he's a guy that just doesn't seem to get that mystique, and everything
he doesn't have that it factor.
No, he doesn't. But if for some reason he was a massive star in Japan, you know, and there've been other guys like that. You know, I mean, Ben talked about Scott Norton being a massive star in Japan and never being a massive star anywhere else, and we've all talked about Michael Elgin. You know, a guy who has all the attributes and is a good wrestler, but doesn't seem to make it in an American audience the way he does in Japan. In Japan, he's an absolute superstar, but in America, he doesn't. It doesn't quite click with Ring of Honor crowds the way he clicks with New Japan crowds.
In Japan, he's unique.
Yeah, and I suppose
that, in the US, he's just another big guy.
Yeah, I suppose that's what you could say about Tiger Jeet Singh. He was unique. He was, you know, this swashbuckling Indian prince who managed to parlay quite a long career in Japanese wrestling out of these few victories over Inoki, but he was over like Rover with New Japan crowds as a heel. And this contradiction between strong style as a sports-based presentation, but they're still having to put the soap opera in to make it an attraction. It's interesting, fascinates me. Now, perhaps the biggest thing for New Japan in this time period was Antonio Inoki winning the WWWF Championship. Though you won't find that on WWE.com. He beat Bob Backlund, who was fairly irate at the end of the match.
when veins popping out of his head.
There's nothing like a good Bob rant, is there? He looks so realistically upset.
He's just so openly emotional, and in a way that is still like really unusual. He doesn't hold himself back at all.
No. You got to find it. It's well worth it. It was on tour in 1979, Inoki beat him in Tokushima. And then Backlund took the championship back on December the 6th. But the match was, according to Wikipedia, it says here, Hisashi Shinma declared the rematch a no contest due to interference from Tiger Jeet Singh, and Inoki remained champion. Inoki refused the title on the same day because he's a noble chap, and it was declared vacant. Backlund later defeated Bob Duncan in a Texas death match to regain the title on December the 12th. As Inoki refused the title. His reign is not included, nor is it recognized by WWE in its official history. Interesting.
Why do you think that is, that they leave it out?
I think, I don't know. WWE's relationship with New Japan today is very different to what it was back then, because essentially,
yes,
they are the two biggest wrestling promotions in the world, and therefore they are competing for the same market. especially as New Japan Hau has eyes on a bigger market around the world. They're the only real competition left for WWE. You can talk about TNA and Ring of Honor to an extent, but genuinely, the ones that are going to take the biggest lion's shares of the markets that are available in the world are going to be New Japan and WWE, and maybe CMLL. So the relationship now is very different. But WWE had a talent swap relationship with them well into the mid-80s. And I don't really know why they wouldn't do. I mean, I suppose Backlund was the golden boy. He was unstoppable. And the WWF narrative was always a strong-faced champion. You know, Bruno, Pedro Morales, Bob Backlund.
Right.
And any chink in that armor, maybe they thought it would hurt his draw when he was back home.
But, I mean, why do they care about that now? You know? Like, to leave it out of their records of what happened.
Especially when the WWE Championship changes hands at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
You know.
Or when so many of their current stars are people who, well, I mean, increasing numbers of their current stars, I should say, are people who they've borrowed from New Japan Pro.
Yeah, exactly. And you would have thought it would make sense. And of course, Inoki's a WWE Hall of Famer as well. You know, so surely you would want to give him all of his due, wouldn't you? Really? You know,
you would think.
But
he's still around. He's 73 and still involved in wrestling to some extent, supposedly.
Yeah, I mean, that's maybe something you could do on the next big Tokyo Sumo Hall show is like invite Inoki.
Oh, that would be cool.
And reinstate his championship reign. You know, that would be cool. That would be something they could do, you know, and it would probably do more for them than sticking Nakamura on top, in one sense. You know, it's interesting that, and we talk about it a lot, WWE's version of history is intriguing for what they leave out rather than for what they put in.
Yes.
We have got a couple of other big names to talk about as well in this particular era of New Japan Pro Wrestling. And possibly the biggest name in pro wrestling of all time, Hulk Hogan, and possibly the biggest name in sports ever, Muhammad Ali. Do you want to take Hogan first or Muhammad Ali first?
Let's do Hogan first so we can end on like a happier note.
I made Chelsea watch Hulk Hogan matches this week and she doesn't like me anymore.
I'm sorry, we can't be friends anymore. No, it's okay. Hogan matches in Japan are weird, man. So Wikipedia is going to tell you that Hulk Hogan was a more technical wrestler when he was in Japan than he was in the United States. And that is technically true, but let's just be clear, he was still terrible. Like, I mean, I personally always find him unwatchable, but he's still no sells for no reason. He still doesn't really know how to build that like sense of drama that a lot of other people that were his contemporaries had grasped. It's interesting watching him in the ring with Inoki because Inoki does sell. Like, he doesn't no sell, but he also doesn't do the super athletic showboating that I think probably a lot of us are used to now. And he steps up his selling to make Hogan, I think, look, I'm going to say, halfway competent. He takes bumps in a way that looks very athletic, but he manages to make Hogan look good. It's interesting seeing two guys who are both very accustomed to being, you know, treated like the biggest badass.
Yeah.
Especially since the crowd in both of the matches I watched is clearly like 100% behind Inoki, and Hogan is the evil gaijin who still, I think, was sort of trying to wrestle like a baby face.
Yeah, I think he was trying to plant seeds, but those seeds weren't growing. They did turn face. You know, Hulkamania really started in Tokyo. It didn't start in New York, certainly not. It didn't really start in Minnesota. You know, he became a big star in Japan as a babyface wrestler, running to the defense of Inoki almost by accident in a tag match, and the crowd absolutely erupted. And I think Inoki was like, yep, I think we've got our next Gaijin superstar here. And, you know, he did...
He knew money when he saw it.
Yeah, he's not daft. Antonio Inoki is many, many things. Stupid is not one of them. and, yeah, he became a big face star. But you're right, he didn't really... Nothing changed that much as far as Hogan was concerned between being a babyface and a heel. You know, he was just kind of doing his thing as a heel, not really reacting to the crowd, but doing the same kind of thing. And then as he became a face, he opened up a lot more. And the kind of hallmarks of Hulkamania you see in New Japan in the late 70s and early 80s, like the actual his kind of match style and his kind of development. He had a harder time in Japan getting that stuff over because he had such a big plethora of wrestlers to deal with. You know, he's wrestling Inoki one night and he's wrestling Abdullah the Butcher the next, you know, which is not the way it works in certainly in Minnesota. He'd be married to Nick Bockwinkel for 3 months. You know, they were going to get real good at it in the end.
Right.
But there's no other option to get good at it. But in New Japan, because of the way, you know, the tours worked to make things interesting, they chopped and changed it. You weren't on the road the whole month. You were on the road for 2 weeks. So that style of wrestling really opened up Hogan. I think he was definitely a lot better in Japan. I'd much rather watch his days in New Japan Pro Wrestling than watch his days in the WWE, to be honest with you, actual wrestling content. In fact, but equally, Hogan wasn't daft either. He adapted himself to his audience a lot. You know, when he went down to WCW and fans absolutely despised him because he was from the WWF as it was then, and he started throwing in a few chain wrestling holds and the fans still reacted to that. And it not occurred to him that, you know, these fans are different because they're just wrestling fans. And Hogan adapted his style only a little bit. But if you watched in that early pre-NWO Hulk Hogan, his style develops in WCW. He comes in trying to do what he did in the WWE and it's not hitting on all cylinders at all. And then he slowly adapts his style until he could get something out of it with the fans. And he did the same thing in Japan, but it wasn't as... He didn't have the experience, to be honest with you, to do it as overtly as he did later in his career. But he certainly was a good foil for Inoki as the evil Gaijin and became a really over babyface in that particular time period. And it was another factor. My one recommended match from that era for Hogan isn't against Inoki. It would be against Abdullah the Butcher because the Butcher was... You know, a bit. The Butcher was firing on all cylinders at that time. It was his really kind of zenith as the big bad monster heel, and Hogan was, you know, just trying to establish himself as a babyface, and that meant, you know, they were both trying really, really hard to get each other over, and it worked really, really well. And you wouldn't have thought that that would make a good match, would you? Abdullah the Butcher versus Hulk Hogan. That's never going to be anything to watch.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not always about great sporting spectacle, it's sometimes about drama, and they were able to do that. And you're right, I'm sorry for making you watch all those Hogan matches. I hope you don't hate me.
It's okay.
But he was an important figure in New Japan Pro Wrestling, and certainly with that WWF talent swap agreement, certainly I think Vince McMahon Jr. would have seen enough of Hulk Hogan to get a rough idea of what was going to happen when he came back to North America.
It's the beginnings of the blueprint.
Yeah, it's the idea in somebody's head of what could happen. Now, the other person we was going to talk about is Muhammad Ali and the shoot fight that took place in 1976 in Tokyo with Antonio Inoki.
That sort of possibly wasn't supposed to be a shoot fight.
Yeah, this one's tricky. This one's really hard to describe because it kind of started off as a work. As a sporting spectacle, and as these things keep on a rolling, things start going wrong. You know, the initial idea was that it would be a rigged match. That was the idea, you know. But then Ali's camp kind of started to worry that Inoki would shoot on Ali. And Ali...
Oh, see, I read it the other way around.
There's numerous...
Ali thought it was supposed to be a worked match, and Inoki never wanted it to be, and was incredibly, like, overtly insistent that it had to be a real fight.
This is it. It depends on where you look it from. The best story I read If you go to the Guardian website, there is a story called, there's a section in the Guardian called The Forgotten Story Of, and it's usually a big sports story. And The Forgotten Story of Muhammad Ali and Antonio Inoki is about a 4,000 word story explaining the whole thing. And there's, you're right in the sense of it goes back and forth, because at one point Ali was like okay with it being a rigged fight, but then he's like, but then I'm taking money away from little old grandmas in Kentucky who think they're seeing a real fight. You know, that he had a real kind of...
he had a really strong sense of ethics.
Yeah, a big moral issue with it. And then, you know, there's the other issue that Inoki probably wanted it to be a shoot, because he could take Ali in a shoot. You know, as much as...
Oh, absolutely.
You know, Ali was the greatest heavyweight boxer of all time, probably. I'm not a boxing expert, and some people have queried that, but let's be honest, he was the biggest name in sports. But as great as Ali was as a boxer, going up against a shoot fighter who knew more than one style, he was going to lose. He wouldn't want that. You know, Ali just could not do that, unless he could take Inoki in a straight-up stand-up fight, which it wasn't going to be, because Inoki's strength was being on the mat.
Yes.
So that wasn't going to happen, was it? You know, that was the crux of the matter. Now, so Ali's going into it thinking it's going to be a work, or possibly, or, you know, Inoki's definitely going to shoot on him. That's what they're thinking about. And so they changed the rules, and they changed the rules around to give Ali a slight advantage of, I think he was not allowed to kick above the waist. Yeah, here we go.
Not allowed to kick above the waist. If he was kicking, he had to, from the mat, he had to have one knee on the mat at all times. It's Inoki's not allowed to throw. He's not allowed to grapple or tackle Ali. And he has to... he's not allowed to... Is it not allowed to touch the ropes? I think he's not allowed to touch the ropes when they make contact with each other.
So essentially, everything Inoki can do to take an advantage, he can't do.
99% of it, yeah.
Because if you know anything about MMA or anything about grappling, then you understand that a wrestler's key points is being able to tackle somebody or to single leg them or double leg them. You know, it'd be ridiculously hard for a wrestler to beat anybody without being able to single leg them. To just be like, well, you're taking away his right arm. So, you know, and the actual fight itself was promoted all across the world. This fight was a closed circuit television draw. It was a big draw in New York for Vince McMahon Sr. It was even a big draw in Oklahoma for our good friend JR Jim Ross himself. He bought money into it because he thought it was going to be, you know, a big money win as far as closed circuit television was concerned. It wasn't. Well, it was, but, you know,
the
match itself.
They called it the bout of the century, and 1.4 billion people, according to the Japan Times, watched it. So it made money.
It made money. It wasn't very good. Because for 15 rounds, Ali basically...
It's awful.
Yeah. Because 15 rounds, Ali can't punch Inoki because he's on the floor. And Inoki can't attack Ali because the rules say he can't attack Ali. And they just dance around for 15 rounds. And Inoki keeps kicking Ali in the legs. And arguably, that's one of the reasons why he lost his World Heavyweight Championship a few months later.
He had an infection, actually, from one of the injuries and blood clots, which caused permanent damage to his legs that pained him for the rest of his life.
Yeah, so you can see that this was a situation that really wasn't good for anyone. You know, it wasn't good for Inoki. In the one sense, it was good for Inoki because he had nothing to lose. He's just a fake wrestler, and if he can survive 15 rounds with Ali, he survived 50 rounds with the greatest fighter on earth. But it wasn't good for Ali because it was supposed to be a quick money fix, and it didn't necessarily work out that way. And it certainly wasn't quick either. Ali also did a bunch of other wrestler versus boxer bouts in preparation for this in Minnesota and in New York as well. And also on the closed circuit promotion of this, I believe Andre the Giant faced another boxer too. In a worked fight, and he backdropped him halfway across. It was where the Mets play. Shea Stadium, yeah. Yeah, it was Shea at the time, yeah.
You'd think I would know that.
Yeah, Andre backdrops said boxer halfway into the crowd in Shea Stadium. So, you know, this was it was good for wrestling, not necessarily good for boxing. And there's plenty of things you can read about it and other opinions other than ours in this particular piece of work, because it was a very interesting time, but it did establish the idea that strong style wrestling was realism, and that's really what Inoki was trying to do. He was trying to establish that wrestling was a martial art, and professional wrestling could justifiably be seen as a sport to make all the other stuff in New Japan Pro Wrestling work.
It's also I was encouraged by the fact that Ali and Inoki developed a real life friendship afterwards. They had enough in common that even though this match was kind of a failure, they got each other personally.
Yeah, that's it. And in fact, Inoki converted to Islam later in life. You know, he's a Sunni Muslim, just like Muhammad Ali. So, you know, obviously they had a great effect and affection for each other. So I think that is a nice note to end on there, isn't it, really? You know,
well, I have one more really cool thing that I found, which was that the Bombaye catchphrase that was part of Ali's music, Inoki started using it as his catchphrase and started using it in his music after this match, because Ali gave him permission to do it, because even though it was a failure, they had, you know, such profound respect for each other that Ali totally was okay with the idea and actually was kind of flattered by it. And I just think it's so cool that that was the name that Nakamura used for his famous knee strike.
Yep.
As a tribute to Inoki. And I looked it up. The reason that WWE made him change it to the Kinshasa is probably that it means kill him. In Lingala.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
And that's not quite as palatable a name for all time zones. but I don't know. I just, that little thread of continuity there, I just thought was so cool.
It is. It's a wonderful thing, isn't it? You know, and obviously Muhammad Ali passed away earlier this year. In fact, I wrote a story on WrestleTalk.tv about Ali and his effect on pro wrestling. And if you want to go have a read of that, I'd really appreciate it. And, you know, to me, Ali was, George Foreman's put it best, he wasn't the greatest boxer of all time, he was the greatest man who ever boxed, which I think is really important to understand. And I think his effect on the wrestling business was basically because he got it. He understood how to draw a ticket, just like every other wrestler understands how to draw a ticket. And Ali was very influenced by pro wrestling as well. You know, one of the reasons why he was so motor-mouthed and talked so much was because he was a big Gorgeous George fan. You know, he was a wrestling fan first before he became a boxer. You know,
I didn't know that. That's so cool.
Yeah, he understood how to get people into a building and how to sell a ticket. That's why he became boxing's biggest attraction. And, you know, I'm pretty sure boxing could do with two or three more of those guys right now.
Yes.
But that pretty much wraps us up for today on our Beginner's Guide to Japanese Wrestling. And we've looked at Strong Style, Antonio Inoki, and the birth of New Japan today. I'd like to thank my guest for today, Ms. Chelsea Spollen. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
It's been fantastic. And you can follow Chelsea at Chelsea Comics on Twitter, as well as Shoulders Up at Shoulders_Up. You can follow me at Sheriff Lone Star on Twitter. We appreciate it. We also appreciate you filling in them iTunes reviews there. We appreciate that greatly, and we've had some fantastic stuff. One of them recently said that James's infectious love of New Japan has made me a New Japan Pro Wrestling fan, so I greatly really appreciate that.
Aww.
I was just like, oh, that's why I do this stuff, because I want people to enjoy wrestling. And I think if you talk to Chelsea and Gavin and Paul and Alex and all the other guests we have on the Troopany show, and Marcus and the other Alex as well, that's the reason why we do this. We want you to enjoy wrestling and give you as much information as we can to help you enjoy it more. So thank you very much for listening to us, and this has been the Troopany show. Take care. Bye.